This is WordPress Weekly, your source for the latest news, plugins, and interviews with influential leaders in the WordPress community. Here's your hosts, Jeff Chandler and Marcus Couch.
Welcome, everybody, to episode 158 of WordPress Weekly for Wednesday. I didn't say Friday, I said Wednesday, August 13th, 2014. I am your host, Jeff Chandler, and joined by my co-host, Marcus Couch. Marcus, do you realize that as we record this show, it is dark time? It's nighttime. The moon is out where I'm doing the show.
Well, it's still nice and sunny here in Southern California here at 6:30 p.m., but yeah, it's got a whole new vibe to the show. We've got a whole new setup, and we got a really killer guest today.
Killer in that he's awesome, not in the other whatever ways could be determined with killer.
Well, I don't know. I can't speak for him on that level.
All right, well, I guess we'll get his take on that later. Let's get into some news topics, and then we'll actually speak with our guest here in a little bit. But first thing I want to tell you is that WP SiteCare has acquired AuditWP. Now, AuditWP was created by Robert New and Jacob King, and I believe Robert's wife, I think, if I have that correct. Hopefully I have that correct. But it was an SEO service, so it helped you out in terms of ranking, and it did auditing of your website to increase your rankings, SEO type stuff. Anyways, they've been acquired by WP SiteCare. So according to the announcement, AuditWP will operate under WP SiteCare while continuing to offer specialized SEO services. And Robert New, who owned and operated AuditWP, will become WP SiteCare's Director of Digital Strategy. So that's pretty cool. I know in the announcement, News cited his passion for wanting to help businesses and individuals as one of the primary reasons for merging with WP SiteCare. And I figure, hey, you know, WP SiteCare is all about helping people. They're a maintenance and troubleshooting service at its core. So with him joining WP SiteCare, I think he'll have nothing but opportunities to help people. So congratulations to both Ryan Deed Sullivan and Robert New on the acquisition, and I think the company's going to go far.
Yeah, I agree with Robert on that point as far as helping out local businesses and things. You know, we often forget that WordPress is not just for, you know, blogs or just affiliate sites. There are actual mom and pop, you know, local businesses that a good WordPress site can make all of the difference for them, whether that be a restaurant or your local lawyer or dentist, things like that. You know, WordPress gives you the tools to optimize and do all of those kinds of things to get, you know, very favorable rankings within Google. So congratulations to Robert and his whole team.
Excellent. And new hints that some new SEO training packages are being worked on, and a new plugin is being developed that will make it easier for WP SiteCare customers to receive support from the WordPress dashboard. So if you're a member of WP SiteCare, definitely keep your eyes and ears open for that plugin. So we're going to go into, Marcus, I believe you have some plugin picks near the end of the show. But before we get into those, I don't know if you do or not, but If you do. I want to get into one plugin really quick here that I came across today. This is brand new, hot off the press, right out of the oven. It's a new WordPress plugin that spell checks post titles before publishing. So this is kind of weird because I've been using WordPress for years, and occasionally I have published a post where I go, you know, I do a facepalm because after I publish a post and it's live and everybody sees it, or even a few days after the fact, I notice that there is a typo or a misspelling in the post title. Well, unbeknownst to me, WordPress out of the box does not do spell checking for the post title. So this plugin, it's called Post Title Spell Check, developed by Robert New and Brady Vercher. There's no settings attached to it. All you do is install it, activate it, and it does spell checking for you within the WordPress post titles. So really cool, convenient plugin. I did come across a guide that explains how to change a configuration file within Firefox, if that's your browser of choice, which would also allow you to do spell checking in WordPress post titles. Unfortunately, that would tie you to just that browser having the spell check. This plugin is actually uses technology and web standards so that it's able to be used in all the modern web browsers. So I think you'd have to weigh that choice whether you want to use it just in your browser or in any browser, but I think actually I think having the plugin installed, this is actually excellent for multi-user sites who have the ability to generate posts, because then they'll be able to use it, and it'll whatever browser they're using most likely will support being able to do spell checking in the post titles.
I wonder also if that works in widget titles as well.
I have not tried that out. I know that this plugin is specifically deals with the input field, input post title field. So I'm not sure. It's probably just centered on that piece of that text area. I'm not sure if it does the widget, but that would be another nice addition to do. I believe spell checking is enabled in the text widget, you know, in the widget content. But yeah, I mean, I don't know if the widget title has that functionality.
We shall see.
Anyways, it's free, it's quick and easy to use, and just one of those things that I wonder if at some point down the line WordPress would be able to support, you know, in core. It's just one of those really small things that would be a benefit to people who generate content, which is like, you know, most of the people that use WordPress.
Doesn't it seem like it's one of those things that somebody just forgot? Oh, darn, we forgot to put it in there too.
You know? Yeah, it's interesting because as I was doing research for this, I found out that back in March of 2006, there was a post written about WordPress.com and how they were adding a spell checker to the service so that you could spell check posts. And in that post, they had mentioned that you could not spell check the title in the post. So it's been like that for so many years now on WordPress.com. Maybe it is something that was just forgotten. Or, you know, who knows, maybe there's a legitimate reason why it's not already in WordPress. But it would be nice to see, maybe, if possible, if it could be used, added to WordPress in the future.
There should be rioting in the streets, people demanding it.
I don't know about that. I don't know if it's all about that, but just would be pretty neat to have.
It would be nice, yes.
So with that said, that's about it so far in terms of the news. I mean,
yeah, it's a pretty slow news week in terms of WordPress.
Yeah, slow news week is okay with me. So let's bring on our awesome guest here, or as you like to say, killer guest. His name is Pippin Williamson. He's an avid WordPress plugin developer from Hutchinson, Kansas, way out in the middle of nowhere. I don't know about that. I mean, it's in the Central Plains. And he's the lead developer of Affiliate WordPress. Along with Affiliate WordPress, Pippin is the founder of Easy Digital Downloads, which is a complete e-commerce plugin for selling digital products through WordPress, and Restrict Content Pro, which is a plugin for managing and selling memberships to premium content. And last but not least, he is also a volunteer as a member of the Plugin Directory Moderation Team, or as I like to say, one of the gatekeepers to the WordPress Plugin Directory. Pippin, man, thank you for taking some time out of your schedule this evening and being on the show.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
So let's get this out of the way. Are you a killer person? A killer isn't awesome, or
Dexter-like?
well, I'd really try to avoid being Dexter-like, so we'll go with the first one.
All right, killer isn't awesome.
Those are my two options.
That's how I see it. So just a quick question for you. I mean, I don't talk to very many people who live out there in the plains. When a store moves over Hutchinson, Kansas, I mean, is it just a natural thing to just move to the basement with every storm that comes through, or is it not like that?
No, it's really not like that at all. We're pretty used to a lot of thunderstorms in the area, and when we do get a severe one that might have the capability of producing a tornado or severe weather like that, we are cautious and we pay attention to it. But honestly, I think over the last 2 years, I think there's two storms that I've gone to my basement, and that was it. And that's out of hundreds.
Now, in that area, have you ever seen a funnel cloud or actual tornado on the ground?
I have not, and I've lived here my whole life.
Wow, interesting. And this has nothing to do with the WordPress, but my passion, my other passion besides WordPress is weather. And I just have a fascination with it. So it's just awesome to sort of talk to somebody who lives right there smack dab in Tornado Alley.
We do see some really cool weather here. I mean, sometimes people's definition of cool weather differs a little bit. I love storms. The thing that I always want to do when a big storm rolls in is go to the tallest building I can and watch it. Or go out in an
A skyscraper in Chicago and watch it roll in like it's the end of the world.
When I was at college, about 3 hours away from where I live now, the campus was on top of a really large hill, and it was the only hill in the area. So you go to the top of the hill, and then on top of that was an eight-story classroom building. And so you could go to the top, and it was all built out of limestone. It wasn't going to go anywhere, but you could go to the top, and you could see in every single direction, and you could see any storm that came in, and it was just awesome to watch it from there.
Man, that sounds like my – Pippin, you're my kind of guy.
Come on down.
What's just out of curiosity, what's the largest size – ice ball you've seen hail?
I've seen a golf ball. No, sorry, not golf ball. Softball sized hail.
Holy smokes! That'll kill you if it hits you in the head.
Oh yeah, that's like punch a hole through your roof type hail.
My goodness, that is incredible. So, what inspired before WordPress? What did you do to earn your living? How did you end up getting involved with WordPress?
I would say I started with WordPress pretty early on. In my professional career, when I was at college at the University of Kansas, I was doing some really basic web development, and I was kind of doing it on the side just as a little bit of supplemental income. And I actually got into WordPress from my brother because he ran a WordPress site, and he's like, "Hey, you do some web development? You want to make some tweaks for me?" But I did web development, just building general sites for clients for probably about a year and a half or so before I really got into WordPress. And before that, or actually at the same time as all that, I worked backstage at a theater that had a lot of touring Broadway shows come in.
Interesting. Cool. So how did you, you're just doing some tweaks for your brother, and then did you end up deciding, hey, why don't I start doing this on my own?
Kind of. I actually hated it at first. I thought it was terrible.
Well, WordPress or just working with it, the code?
The code base. It was early enough in my experience with WordPress that I actually hadn't even got into really using the admin area. I wasn't using it for my own sites or anything like that. I was just trying to modify some template files for my brother, basically making some little CSS tweaks here and there. And I looked at it, I was like, what is all this PHP junk? Like, why do I need this? I don't really know at what point it turned into me really liking it, but it was at some point over the next 6 months or so after I started on that.
As I mentioned here on the show last week, once you get that WordPress bug, you know, that aha moment, you just something, the engines, the gears start turning, you start getting involved with it, and you start wanting to learn everything you can about how the darn thing works.
Yeah, it really just kind of sticks with you.
I think it's at the moment that you install a plugin and you realize it just saved you a billion hours of time.
Yeah, definitely. That one... I don't remember what my first experience too with installing plugins was, but I do remember early enough on, before I was writing any plugins or doing any advanced PHP development, I was trying to build a site, actually with my sister. We were trying to build one to catalog like outdoor areas in our city, and like parks and recreation areas, and we were building it all off of different plugins that we had available to us. And I remember thinking, like, this is amazing that we have all these different features just available as things that I can just install on the site.
And then on top of all that, to think that they were all probably free.
They were.
Yeah. And short codes. When you did your first short code, it was like, oh, finally.
Yep.
So you're the lead developer. You've created something, a little e-commerce system called Easy Digital Downloads. What inspired you to create that? Is it based on experiences from actually going through other e-commerce websites, making purchasing products, just saying, hey, you know, I could do something that's better than this, or is it something else?
It was to scratch my own itch. So when I started writing it, I had actually been selling plugins both on my own site and through marketplaces like Code Canyon for about 2 years. And I wanted to move everything to my own site, and I wanted to have a good way to sell them. And I wasn't really happy with any of the e-commerce solutions that were out there at the time. Like, there were some of them that were really, really good. I know WooCommerce was out at the time, and WP-Commerce was there, JigoShop was there, Shop was there. There were all of these different e-commerce solutions, and they all had different areas that they shined in. But I didn't really like any of them specifically for selling digital products, and in this case, selling WordPress plugins. I felt like there was a bunch of things in each one of them that I didn't need, and it was just kind of extra stuff sitting there around, sitting there taking up space, taking up UI, possibly taking up performance of my server, etc. So I wanted to build something that was very specific to what I needed.
And that story is repeated time and time again when I bring on guests and people who have created products that they've built their business around. For the most part, it's just something, you know, it started off as scratching their own itch. Then they've noticed, hey, it scratches the itch for a lot of other people as well. Hey, look, now I got a business going.
Yep, definitely. The first version of Easy Digital Downloads, or EDD, was very, very different than what it is now. And not just because of how the product has evolved, but because early on, I built the really basic functionality that I needed to sell a plugin. It had almost zero features, but it worked for what I needed. And then I realized that other people could use it as well, and that's when it started to get a lot more advanced and get new things added and changed from a very minimal implementation of something that allowed me to sell plugins and deliver a download link to a full e-commerce system.
Now, how did you deal with that transition of, okay, this is a plugin, I'm developing it to suit my own needs. Okay, now I see that there's feature requests coming in. Now I have to start thinking about how other users are going to use this. That, okay, this might be fine with me, but if these other 20 or 30 people that use my plugin, you know, if it's terrible for them in terms of the user experience, I can't do things that way. How did you handle that transition?
It's definitely a challenge that we see. I mean, every single day in plugin development, anytime that we're building or modifying a feature, it makes it a little bit easier because of the fact that I eat my own dog food, and so I use the plugin that I'm building. And so you have that experience both as the developer of the system, but also as somebody who is using it as a user, which gives us a little bit more insight into the way that users are using it. But it's still a challenge. I mean, we have to think, oh, I like it this way, but we have 10 people saying they want it this way. And figuring out what to do in those kind of situations is difficult. There's not really a straightforward answer to it, other than you try and weigh the benefits and the cost of each option.
Yes, sort of like the WordPress project itself, except you're on a much smaller scale. You have to deal with the same design, the philosophies, and the decisions versus options and things of that nature, except it's on a much smaller scale.
Yep, which definitely can make it a whole lot easier to manage.
So I've heard from some people that the name of your e-commerce product is a bad choice because it immediately tells folks it only handles digital products. But is that really the case?
So technically, no. It actually handles both. It can handle some very simple physical products, and it can also handle things like services or event tickets and other things like that. And it's absolutely true that the naming convention for the plugin doesn't really suit those criteria, and it's kind of an unfortunate side effect of a plugin growing from something that was very, very focused on only digital products into something that applies to a much greater range of services and products and things like that. It's actually something that we have considered before is rebranding it into something that doesn't have that same connotation. I mean, I don't know if that will happen, but it's definitely occurred to us.
Have you actually heard from customers themselves saying, hey, I've been looking for an e-commerce product. Yours was recommended. Yours looks really cool, but I don't necessarily have a digital product. Will it handle other products? Have you had inquiries such as that?
Yes, quite a few of them. We actually have a couple of extensions for the plugin that are built specifically around the idea of removing file download functionality. We have, for example, we have one called Downloads as Services, and basically it removes some download functionality. It renames the download term to service and for things like that for that exactly that case.
Interesting.
That's one of the few instances I've ever heard of anyone doing an actual removal patch like them.
Yeah, most of the time people are adding features, but we remove them for specific cases.
I mean, in a way, that's almost your way of white labeling.
Yeah, definitely.
That's pretty interesting. So do you keep an eye on A/B testing posts and theories and studies related to e-commerce? And do those findings of those detailed studies influence the development decisions at all with EDD?
Definitely. I probably don't pay as much attention as I could. I mean, there's so much information out there. It can be kind of hard to swallow it all. But any time that we are discussing a change, for example, to our checkout flow or something to do with the checkout or the overall purchasing process, we do try and back it up with evidence as opposed to personal opinions. A couple of versions back, we actually did a really major redesign of the entire checkout flow. And the original redesign that I proposed got completely thrown out the window because we found a bunch of evidence and several people came forward with really hard evidence that said that that was not a good idea and that we should do something else instead. And it turns out it worked out really, really well because of having that evidence to back it all up.
Well, was that, if I remember correctly, did that have something to do with like a skinnier or a narrower checkout page?
That happened as well. That was actually later on. But we did discover, based on I did some personal tests, some A/B tests, and I also looked up some studies that found in general that a skinny checkout page actually converts significantly better than one that's really wide. And so that discovering that has led into us modifying not only our own sites, like the EDD site, my personal site, and any other site I run, but also like modifying any theme that we build for EDD will have a skinnier checkout form.
Can you elaborate on that for the listeners out there as far as, you know, what you mean by that and,
sure,
and what those conversion rate differences may be?
Sure. So the overall conversion rate can vary depending on the website. Just for this specific example, I ran an A/B test on the easydigitaldownloads.com website for several months, and I presented the customers that were going through the purchase process with two options. One was a checkout screen that was approximately 960 pixels wide, and one was a checkout screen that was approximately 660 pixels wide. And over the course of 3 months or so, we discovered that the skinny version that was about 660 pixels wide had an increase of conversions by over 3-4% just by changing the width. Nothing else changed, only the actual width of the page. And wow. So, like, those little tiny details can have a huge impact on e-commerce.
That's the fascinating thing about e-commerce for me.
It really is.
You know, when I follow Shop, and Shop is really big into this, linking to studies and theories and things
like
that.
They do better at linking to data like that than anyone else I know.
And it's just fascinating that you change the color of this button and more people will buy from you. Or
yep,
you push this over 20 pixels, you get more people to buy from you. I mean, it's insane the nuances that can contribute to increased conversion.
Yeah, it's crazy.
I just read a study where if you have photos, let's say on a slider, and you have whatever the call to action is, either the left side, the right side, underneath, whatever, the pictures of the people that you have in the slider, if you point the angle of the photography so that they're all looking at where the call to action is on the website, that you convert like 10% higher.
That's wild.
That's crazy.
It's the theory of, you know, if you're walking down the street and 50 people are looking up,
you're going to pay attention. That's crazy. I did another one recently where we had purchase buttons, basically like go to a pricing page and there's a button that says buy now or purchase now, different things like that. And we discovered that changing the text from buy now to purchase actually dramatically increased conversions.
Wow, I wonder, and when you look at these studies, it's a lot of it is actually like psychological, like deals with the brain, the mind share, things of that nature, what we think, what we see, habits and things of that nature. It's crazy. It's cray cray.
Yeah, it's nuts.
So Easy Digital Downloads, you're the lead developer, but you're certainly not the only developer. In fact, I've been lucky enough to meet some of your other team members, and you have a great dedicated team of volunteers that are just dead set on helping you improve Easy Digital Downloads. What's that been like for you to manage a team? First of all, what was it like when you initially received help from outside, you know, the community wanting to help improve your plugin, and how have you managed more and more contributors to the project?
So first of all, it's been really, really awesome. Going alone on a project can let you go really quickly, but as iThemes will always tell you, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. And I think that's really, really true. So we started first bringing other people on and looking for other people to contribute to EDD. I think when it was just a couple of months old, I could look it up. I wrote a blog post originally basically saying, hey, I'm looking for development help on this plugin. If you want to help out, here's how you can do it. And I think within the first 6 months, we had somewhere between maybe 5 and 20 people that had contributed to it. And now we're up to about 104 people that have contributed an actual code patch. So if we actually look at the true number of contributors, it's probably closer to 200, because we have to think about people that have just reported bugs or people that have provided feedback. But the number of people that have contributed an actual code change is 104 right now.
And what mechanism do you use to track all of that and the feedback back and forth and the contributions and such?
We use a service called GitHub, which is most developers are familiar with it, but for anyone who's not a developer, basically it is an online system where we can store the code base, we can track changes, we can keep track of bugs and enhancements, and we can have internal discussions based on any of those changes. It also allows us to have different versions of the plugin simultaneously. So if I'm working on a big new feature, I can keep that within what's called a branch, and then somebody else who's working on a big new feature can have a separate branch, and then people can test either one independently of each other. So it's a really nice development tool.
Well, would it be appropriate to call it the social collaboration tool?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think one of their official taglines, something like that, like social coding or something.
Well, that would make sense. Tell me a little bit about this individual, which seems to be just a rock star. And if I remember correctly from what you told me at the various WordCamps we've met each other at, I think you sort of took this person under your wing, and he's improved leaps and bounds. His name is Andrew Munro, and I think he goes by the name of Samobi.
Yeah. Yeah.
And tell us a little bit about when he got involved with the project and how he's grown since you've taken him under your wings.
So Andrew is awesome. Andrew was one of the early contributors to EDD. He is, I don't remember what his first contributions were, but he's played a really large part on a lot of the more like the design aspects of EDD, some of the overall user experience and user interfaces. He's also one of our primary extension developers. So the entire business model of EDD is built around the selling of premium extensions. And he's the author of, I think, around 10 or 12 extensions, a couple of them which are some of our best extensions overall, both in terms of revenue and in terms of features. He's also now my partner on another project called Affiliate WP. And he does all of the support, all of the site design, et cetera. And then he also does a ton of support for EDD. And overall, it's just been a huge asset.
Yeah, is it true that he sort of got involved? I mean, is he the example where you had mentioned that his code, his quality of code, wasn't really the best, that he would submit things for review, but now he's he's submitting things to you that don't need to be checked. You can just commit them right to the project because it's that good now?
I think he and just about all of the primary contributors were all that way. I think I remember you and I met at a WordCamp once, and I gave you that example. In that case, we were actually talking about a different one, but it really applies to all of our top five or so contributors, which would be Sonny Rotwell, Chris Christoph, Dan Griffiths, and Andrew Monroe would be the main guys. And every single one of them have gone through that same kind of transformation where some of the initial patches that they've submitted needed a bit of coaching and needed some help here and there. And then as they've gotten better and better, they've not just become better developers, but they've become better. They've become more familiar with the code base and more familiar with the standards that we try to adhere to with the project. And so they have a deeper understanding of how code needs to be written in order to make it into the project. And that's been really fun to see.
I mean, I'm not in your position. I may never be in your position of being able to sit back, being the lead developer of a program and see these pull requests, they call them, or contributions through GitHub regarding your plugin. I mean, what's the feeling like every time you see a patch or a pull request that, you know, fixes something, a bug, squashes a bug that you don't have to worry about?
It's awesome. Having someone send in a pull request, which is simply a set of changes, a proposed set of changes, and see it successfully fix a bug or improve a feature or do something like that, even if it's like one little tiny aspect or if it's a really large feature, it's really great. For one of the obvious reasons is because suddenly that's code that I didn't have to write. Two, I really like to see people taking the time and being invested in this project. To me, it's a project that goes far beyond myself. I may have started it, but in no way am I the only person that works on it. And so I love seeing that. And it's really cool to see a community of developers that are working together on it. In the same way that WordPress itself is built by a community of developers all around the world, I like to see this built in the same way.
Mm-hmm. In the way that you describe that, Pippin, so are you saying that are there levels of it? Are there people that are just coders and people who just point out those little flags that need to be fixed?
Absolutely. Just, I would say, as an example, so Dan Griffiths is our number four contributor in terms of the number of code changes he's gotten committed to the code base, and he's very much a developer. He does use the plugin on his own, but he's very much a developer that's just going through fixing bugs, making improvements, etc. And then we have another user, another contributor to the plugin, who has built a series of themes and other products on top of Easy Digital Downloads, but he doesn't write any code at all. But he's really good at bug reporting and feature suggestions.
So sort of a spotter, I guess you could say.
Yes. Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
And then you got your snipers, which are the code guys that come in and take care of that little problem.
Yep.
So Easy Digital Downloads must be doing something right, because I'm starting to see more and more themes either on ThemeForest or in just commercial theme shops building in support for Easy Digital Downloads. That's got to make you happy.
It definitely does. It's something that we've worked hard for a while to try and encourage. We decided early on that getting more and more themes out there that had support for EDD, and not only had support for EDD, but also went above and beyond in terms of creating special product layouts, creating the checkout flows, etc. We decided that was really important for the overall adoption rate for the plugin. By having more and more themes out there, we can make it easier for users to transition into using the plugin. And so over the last 2 years, I've been working directly with some theme developers and indirectly with others to try and make that happen. So now that it is definitely picking up steam, that does make me very happy.
Is there like a badge or something, like any kind of like certification or approval or something like that that you go through when someone wants to incorporate that into their theme?
It really depends on where they're selling their theme. If we sell it for them, which we do very little in theme sales. We don't focus a lot on themes in terms of for our own site. Mm-hmm. But if we were to host it for them, then we review it extensively. We test it, we review the code, etc. If they sell it on a site such as like ThemeForest or another marketplace, then we'll always review it. But we don't necessarily go line by line to pick through it.
Right. So Pippin, being a father and a business owner with multiple products, affiliate WordPress and EDD, how do you balance your time? How do you balance your schedule? I mean, you also sometimes participate at WordCamp speaking, which involves traveling. How do you balance all that out? I mean, what's your typical workday like?
I try and keep a pretty set schedule. So depending on the day, I will start somewhere between 8 and 9, and I'll quit between 5 and 6. And overall, I may jump on here and there for maybe 20 minutes or so in the evening, but most of the time, that's my work day. I take weekends off, and I work 9 to 5 on during the week, and that frees up the rest of the time to spend with family and get other things done.
How hard has it been to... Or I should say, how hard is it not to deviate from that schedule where, you know, you have your phone, you have a means of maybe getting emails or pull requests, notifications in. I mean, you're surrounded by your work almost at all times thanks to mobile and things of that nature. How hard is it not to deviate from that routine?
It varies from day to day. I mean, for example, if something big happens, I mean, maybe there was a bug report, maybe there was an awesome new pull request that put in or something like that, I do find myself jumping in outside of my normal schedule if needed. But in general, I've been able to stick to it pretty strictly. And I think that's because I really got to a point where I didn't like working all the time. Over the course of the last 6 years or so, as I've been building this up, there was a lot of times I would work 12 to 18 hours a day, and then I would do that six or seven days straight. And it was just because I really, really loved what I was doing, and I loved working. And I still really love what I do, but I've also discovered that I really like my time away from work just as much or more.
Hear.
And so I just say, look, I'm out for the day, or I'm out for the weekend. It'll wait till Monday. It was really hard to get to the point where I could actually say that. But once I did, and I realized that, oh, guess what? The world doesn't burn down in flames when I wait till Monday.
Yeah.
I myself have tried to – I'm sort of in the middle of this whole remote worker experience, and I've been doing it now for over a year. And, you know, this year has been sort of a learning experience where it's like, okay, I can work whenever. I can fit this into my schedule. But it seems like I'm just now starting to realize after all this time that unless I put a routine together and stick to it, then all I'm doing is encouraging chaos. And in the midst of chaos, I cannot control anything. And I'm working through all hours of the day and night and, you know, probably not accomplishing much of anything. So I think I'm really starting to come around to this whole routine thing.
I used to really revel in the idea of not having a routine. Because I was like, oh, I have the freedom. I can work anytime I want. I'm going to work anytime I want. And so sometimes I meant working at 3 in the morning. Sometimes I meant sleeping till noon. And then I realized and figured out that actually I work much better when I do have a routine and I work 9 to 5. And maybe there's a reason this kind of routine exists.
And pardon me, you don't have to answer this. This is sort of a personal question. But that routine and being a remote worker, how much does your family play a role into what your routine is and actually putting that routine together? Because, you know, for me, and when I allowed chaos to ensue in the freedom, I would end up working at night. I'd end up probably not sleeping with my wife most of the week, and she'd be getting upset, saying, "Why don't you ever go to bed with me at the same time?" And all this crazy stuff where, you know, I just wasn't very much of a family man because I was doing things that I wanted to do. But, you know, how much did that sort of have an impact on your routine?
A lot. Early on, so my wife and I have been married for a little over 3 years now. And So when we first got married was still when things were kind of chaotic and I was working crazy hours, and it was challenging. And I know that we had a couple of times when I could tell that, like, she would get visibly upset because I was spending every hour of the day at my workstation working on things. And then I would be working until 3 in the morning, and then I'd get up early, and then I'd work until 3 in the morning again. And I realized that that just wasn't really good for a family and for my obligations to her, and especially then once we had our daughter, who's now 2, that became much more important. And so now it's just kind of our mutual agreement that 9 to 5, I'm at work. Outside of that, it's family time.
Yeah, people often forget that everyone always says, you know, like 9 to 5, that's my work time, but everybody always forgets to schedule their off time.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, and not only schedule your off time, but it's, you know, in my case with the phone and what I do, it's so easy to get sucked back in from off time into work time. So it's really all about discipline, you know, setting those boundaries and sticking to them.
Yep, that's why I try to always leave my laptop in the office. I might take my iPad with me, but there's only so much I can do from my iPad in terms of, like, what I do and from my phone. The worst case that I'm going to go maybe answer an email or two, and that I can just close it and put it away easier.
And how awesome is it as a remote worker that when these national holidays come around, you can actually say, oh, business is closed, I'm not working.
It's nice. It took me a little bit to realize that, though. I used to be like, oh, it's Memorial Day. I work at home. Guess what? I'm still at work. I'm going to go ahead and work today. And I actually do tend to still work on holidays, with a few exceptions, but I changed how I work. My normal work day is going through the things that I have to do, going through customer support, going through important bugs, things like that. And when it comes to a national holiday and I choose to work, I realize I'm going to work on whatever I want to work on today. So if that means that I want to build a new feature, or that means that I want to go do customer support, it doesn't really matter what I'm doing, but I'm going to do what I want to do on those days.
And what are you using during this whole process in terms of project management, task management, things like that, to get by day to day, not just from the code cycle, but also the business cycle?
One of the main things we use is Trello. Trello.com. We use it for managing all of the extensions. So anytime, like, there's an extension that needs reviewed or updated, we keep track of there. A little bit more on the business side of things. I used to do all of my accounting and things like that through two different things. I would use one called Ronin app, which was I did all my invoicing and things like that through it, and all expense tracking. And then I also used one called Mint.com. for tracking budgets and things like that. I stopped using those quite a bit. Like, I still use Ronin a little bit, but that's mostly because I hired an accountant to do it all for me, which made things significantly easier.
I love those accountants.
Yeah. Beyond that, we do all of our – we have a private chat room that the team lives in almost 24/7 or any time that we're online, and that's where a lot of the – discussion and things happen. We use hall.com for that. And beyond that, Google Calendar is really valuable for me personally. I do all of my – I've played with a ton of different, like, task trackers and to-do lists and things like that, and I never settled on one. And then I eventually decided I just like Google Calendar. So I add an event to the day for everything that I'm going to work on. So if I have 10 bugs to work on, I add an event for each bug. If I have specific support tickets I need to go resolve, I'll add an item for each primary support ticket. And I look at that as my – this is what I have to get done today. If I get everything on this list done, everything else is bonus.
So that's how you start your day. You just pop open today on Google Calendar.
Yep.
Do you print it out? Do you check them off, delete them?
I delete them. So as I just open it up as a tab in my browser. As soon as I have it done, I delete it.
And again, you have that discipline to where if you don't complete the list of things that you have for that day, that you maybe put them on the list for the next day instead of staying there all night and making sure that day's list of tasks are done.
Yeah, I used to try and really force myself to always get every single one done, and I wouldn't quit until I did. Now, I still try to get every single one done, but I say, it's 5 or 6 o'clock. This is not crucial. It can wait. I'll punt it to tomorrow.
And there's people waiting in the next room wanting to have dinner with you, you know?
Yep, exactly.
So going back on that topic, you mentioned you have a chat room. I mean, you probably have a room there at your house that is a dedicated office. How important is it for you to have that chat room where everybody hangs out all day, where you anything that's on your mind, you know, you could treat as a water cooler, or if you have an idea, if you want other minds to steam over a feature or user experience, or you want, you know, instantaneously point people to a direction or a ticket, how important has that been for you? Because being a developer, you know, I've experienced this, or I should say being a remote worker, it could be very lonely sometimes.
It's really important, not just for the communication in terms of, like, if I have something that I want to bounce off the team or if I want to talk to one person in particular, but it also gives us that sense of having a co-working space. We all work from our own offices or bedrooms or living rooms or wherever it is. One's in New Zealand, one's in London, one's in Nebraska, I'm in Kansas, and then another one is in Phoenix, and another is in Florida. And so we're all in different parts of the world, but we still kind of have this sense of a co-working space because we all are there talking amongst ourselves on what we're working on. Sometimes it's just kind of goofing around and telling funny stories or finding funny GIFs online, generally coming from like Andrew Norcross's Twitter stream or anything.
But even the funny stuff is important to get out there to interact.
Absolutely.
And mingle. I mean, even that stuff is important for human behavior and interaction.
Let me put it this way. I met one of our team members for the first time while at WordCamp New York City, which was a week and a half, 2 weeks ago. He lives in New Zealand. This is Andrew Monroe. And we had never met before, but we've worked together for almost 2 years. And I'd never met him face-to-face, but I still felt like I knew him when we got together. It wasn't like meeting a total stranger. And that's happened with every single one of the development team that I've met in person now, which is all but one or two of them. And I think that right there is a testament to how important having that constant communication is.
And at what level did you communicate with them? Were you doing Skype chats, Skype talks, you know, things
most
like that? There's a lot of people out there that work with people and never even have a voice chat with them. It's all just text and email and things like that.
To date, I think I've had a grand total of 5 to 10 text chats with each of the team members total.
There you go.
Most of the time, five to ten voice chats. Most of the time, it's text chats.
Now, are those individual, or do you have like an area set up to where everybody can see is what everybody else is posting?
Both. So we have the chat rooms, which are just like any other chat room, whether it's IRC, Slack, HipChat, Google Talk, whatever. And then we also have private one-on-ones.
Okay, which makes sense, because not everything, you know, maybe you just need to ping a team member or something.
Sure. If we have something private or, private for whatever reason.
And so you run that on that hall.com. Is that app-based too?
Yes, it is. Yeah, they have an iPad app, they have a desktop app, an iPhone, an Android, and a web app.
Sounds pretty efficient.
So I'm just wondering, I know you created EDD because you couldn't find a e-commerce solution that fit all of your needs. Do you still sell plugins on CodeCanyon?
Technically, yes, but it's so few that it's a very small portion. I have a couple of plugins that are still there. I would not consider them primary plugins by any means. They sell a couple copies every now and then. Mostly I don't take them down because there's no need to take them down.
Right. I mean, it doesn't hurt you not to have them taken down, so.
Right, exactly.
So can you describe what it's like to sell on CodeCanyon? And because I have this notion that nothing on CodeCanyon is GPL licensed, but is that the case?
No, that's not the case, actually. Now, it used to be, technically speaking, because Envato did not originally offer a GPL license. And so
the choice to license your products under GPL. Right. Same thing with ThemeForest, right?
Right. And so regardless of what the author chose to include with their plugin or their theme, the actual license given to the customer was something different. Now they actually do offer the option to choose a GPL license, and so when a customer purchases it, they are made aware that this is being licensed under the GPL. Selling on Code Canyon was a really great experience for me. Number one, it was the first experience that I ever had selling a commercial plugin. So I didn't have a whole lot to base things off of. I created a little plugin in my spare time, and I threw it up and discovered that every now and then people would pay for it, which was a pretty miraculous experience. But it was really great for a couple of other reasons. Number one, they have really large traffic. And so if you are somebody who does not have a high traffic site, or you're new to the community, or you simply don't have a lot of exposure, something like Code Canyon is a really great asset for you, because suddenly you have hundreds of thousands of people that can see your product without you having to do anything in terms of any direct marketing. Two, they handle all of the infrastructure. Before I had built my own e-commerce system, the idea of figuring out how to put something up for sale that I'd built was a really daunting task. And something like CodeCanyon, and it's still really, really daunting to tons of people. So something like CodeCanyon or any other marketplace-like system is really great for the ease of use. I can sign up an account, I can upload my product, I get it approved, and I'm done. And it's up for sale. I don't have to worry about security. I don't have to worry about any of the technical aspects, anything like that. I don't have to worry about my servers going down. And then I think beyond that, it was there's other things that are really great about it too. There was a sense of community and camaraderie among authors on Code Canyon. So like there was a full discussion board, a forum system on the Envato networks for each of the individual marketplace sites. And all of the item authors would go in and talk to each other and collaborate and bounce ideas off of people. And that was cool. I think that was actually my first real introduction to an online community like that I was avidly a part of. To me, that kind of got replaced by the overall WordPress community. But I would say that I was a member of the Envato community far before I was a member of the WordPress community.
Mm-hmm. With everybody on the same page of just trying to make a buck, what can we do here to improve our conversions, how to get more money, how to make more money creating cool stuff.
Yep.
So we're closing in on an hour here, but I'm not going to let you go, not without this opportunity to talk to you about what it's like to be a gatekeeper of the WordPress plugin directory. What I mean by that is, you and Mika Epstein, and I'm not sure if there's any other people involved, but I know at least you two, any WordPress plugin that is initially submitted to the WordPress.org plugin directory, you two actually scan the plugin to look for blatant errors or security vulnerabilities or maybe incorrect use of enqueuing a script or maybe pinging third parties. What's that experience been like for you? Why did you even decide to get involved with this area of WordPress?
Sure. I got involved, first of all, because Otto asked me to. Otto sent me an email that says, hey, you'd be a good fit. You want to help us review plugins? And I said, sure, sounds fun. And it has been a lot of fun. So that was about a year and a half or 2 years ago now. There's a couple things I really enjoy about it. Number one, I like that sense of giving back to the community. I know that somebody has to do this, and I like being able to contribute back to that effort. Two, I really do like to see all the new plugins that come through the repository. Sometimes we see really, really awesome ones that come through. Sometimes they're super simple. Sometimes they're really advanced. And it's fun to kind of get a first look at some of those. It's also, I think, a good reminder as a plugin developer of where everybody starts. No one starts out as a good developer. And so we see a lot of poor plugins come through. We see a lot of less than stellar ones. And it's not necessarily because they just didn't care or they didn't work hard. It's because they're a new developer and they're still learning. And I think it's really important that we remain humble And we remember that everybody started somewhere. I mean, I've looked back at my own plugins. I've looked back at a lot of other people's own plugins that are awesome developers. And we all wrote crap at some point. And so getting to see all of these different plugins come through that fit in every part of the spectrum in terms of code quality, features, etc., is really enjoyable. And it's also very, I think it helps keep me humble and keep me grounded.
Do you ever respond to some of these people in your reviews with you know, you're pulling your hair out going, what the hell are you doing? You can't do that. I mean, how hard is it to, do you see yourself constantly refraining yourself from saying things that way or?
Not really. I think every now and then, if we have somebody that, let's say we have a plugin that comes through and it doesn't pass the review, and we send them a notice that says, hey, these are the things that you need to improve. And if they fight us on it, then we might get a little bit more direct in terms of saying, like, this is, you have to do it this way, or you can't do this, or why would you do that? But not very often. And sometimes it's simply because of the sheer volume. We use a lot of canned replies and pre-built responses based upon common issues. So out of 40,000 plugins, you can imagine that a lot of them face the same kind of problems based upon their initial submission, whatever those kind of issues are. And so a lot of the initial rejections or review, like messages that says this needs further attention, a lot of those actually come from pre-written responses, simply because of how many plugins go through the queue.
Yeah, and
like
I know
an American Idol judge for plugins. Yes, what? You are going to the repository.
Yeah, I mean, there's a heck of a lot of plugins. Is it just you, Amika? Is it just you two going through the queue all the time?
So technically, there's I think about 10 people that have access to the queue, but Mika and I are the only ones that do it on a daily basis.
Wow.
And when I say Mika and I, what I really mean is that Mika does it every single day, and I do it every couple of days. For every plugin I review, Mika reviews 10.
I mean, some would view that as a thankless job, but for me to you, I just want to say thank you for what you do and volunteering your time to do that. And if she's listening out there, thank you as well for volunteering your time to do that. Have you gotten any emails or replies back from people that say thank you, that I didn't know about this but now I do, and you know, maybe just saying thank you for helping me become a better developer?
We do. So a lot of times we'll have a plugin, and either it's something that's been in the repository or it's a plugin that is just going through the initial review, and we'll send the developer something that they need to work on. Maybe it's sanitizing SQL queries, or maybe it's the way they're loading their JavaScript, or whatever. It could be anything else. And we send them a notice that says, hey, this is an issue and it needs to be addressed. And then once they do, there's a lot of times when the author of that plugin just didn't know it was an issue. And then they'll say, thanks for letting me know. And that's really great, because then we can realize that not only have we made the plugin repository better, but we've also helped contribute to making that person a better developer.
Mm-hmm. Right on. So what's the most common things you see that end up having to automatically reject a plugin the first time it's reviewed? To frame it a better way, what are some most common things you see where you end up rejecting a plugin that maybe budding plugin developers listening to the show can do ahead of time to make sure that they get their plugin through the queue?
So there's two main issues that we see a lot of. One is non-safe SQL queries, so not properly sanitizing data input. We see a lot of that. We see a lot, not as much as we used to, but still quite a bit, of people loading jQuery incorrectly. WordPress provides a very specific API for how to load jQuery and other JavaScript scripts. And we see a lot of people doing that incorrectly. And we see not as much about a code issue, but we see a lot of people taking very run-of-the-mill plugins. There's a few kinds of plugins that we now almost auto-reject because of just how many there already are in the repository.
Wow.
And that would be things like really basic social icons. For example, if you submit a plugin that adds social icons to the bottom of a post, it's probably not going to get in because there's already 150 plus in there. But what we'll say is, hey, thanks for the submission, but we would love to see something that has a few more unique features. If there's something that you can offer, fantastic. And social icons are that way. Google Analytics tracking is that way. And basic contact forms. So we get a ton of plugins that are just really straightforward contact forms. First name, email, message. And really, those three plugins and a couple of others, they don't always get denied, but a lot of times they do because there's just so many.
And are there a lot of people that try and sneak through the back door to put their premium plugin out there with just kind of a lame, light version, or is that a common occurrence?
I don't think we don't really have an issue with that so much. What we will run into, though, are people that have attempted to...
Phone home.
Phoning home is a big one. And what that means for anyone who's not familiar with the term is basically when the plugin is installed or activated, they will send information about the website back to their own servers. And a lot of times it's totally harmless, and they don't realize that it's not allowed, but we don't permit it in the repository unless the user of the plugin gives
an opt out
explicit permission to do it. No, you have to opt in, not opt out.
Oh, okay, okay.
Right.
Which is a pretty important distinction. We do see people that will submit they'll submit some plugin, get it approved, and then they'll completely change the plugin that was submitted. And most of the time, that is with malicious intent. It's not that common, but we do see it.
Now, we have a Simo MJ in the chat room says that if WordPress.org has better search, it should get rid of 90% of social plugins. Do you think that's one aspect of why we're seeing so many of these plugins with similar functionality, or is it just the fact that maybe it's these new developers and they see something that's a need or they want to scratch their itch, and they do it on their own and they submit it to the plugin directory, not realizing there's already about a million other plugins that do that?
I'd definitely say the second. There's definitely a lot of times when somebody will submit a plugin and they simply didn't know one existed, maybe because they didn't find it before they submitted it. But to be honest, I don't think we can ever make that claim with social plugins. if you search social, regardless of how good or bad the search results are on WordPress.org, you're going to find a million results. Now, for other plugins, that does definitely happen. But we never reject a plugin just because there's another one that does the same thing. Social and contact forms are kind of a special case because it's not just a case of there being two or three others. It's a case of there being hundreds of others.
So, is there a better solution for that, like social tagging, like other people giving that a tag as well, as far as what it may be about or the theme of the particular plugin?
Maybe, but in this case, a lot of times when there's developers that are submitting these plugins, they're not submitting it because it fills a unique need in their mind. They're submitting it just because they wrote a plugin, which is great. And honestly, they should have the freedom to do that. Because a lot of people, they write their first plugin, they're like, yes, this is awesome. I wrote a plugin, let's submit it. And that's great. And we do want to really encourage that behavior because that helps get people more involved with writing plugins and releasing them.
And just to bring a side note to it, since you're involved in the repository, you know, I think one of the biggest, lame factors of our community is lack of participation as far as reviews and common problems within the repository, actually giving a review to a plugin or, you know, reporting issues. I think people just sometimes either give up or they kind of forget to, you know, give credit where credit's due.
Definitely.
Well, to your point, I think giving reviews and things of that nature right now is just a big inconvenience to users because you cannot easily do those things from, you know, the back end, like on your install plugins page. You would actually have to go to the plugin modal, do a search, find your plugin, then you could, I think you could probably Radiant review it from there, but I mean, it seems more of an inconvenience than anything else. There's right. got to be an easier way to provide feedback and rate and review plugins within the back end of WordPress than what there is now.
Yeah, sounds like an idea for a plugin to actually link to the slug if it's in the repository.
Yeah, that'd be very cool.
And
right
give
now,
it a review, give it a review link, you know, that somebody can
right now, in order for someone to give a review, they have to decide that they want to go and give it a review.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just hey, look, I could leave a review. I'm going to go ahead and do that while inside of WordPress or something like that. It's the, hey, I liked this plugin, or I really hated this plugin. Let me go tell somebody publicly about this.
Yeah, and then you run into the problem where, hey, if it works out great for you, chances are you probably won't say anything about it. Maybe you might write it in the blog post, but you're not going to go give it a 5-star review. But if it ruins your site and you come up with a white screen of death, oh, for sure, you're going to go give it a 1-star review.
Well, maybe, you know, plugin developers should take kind of more of the app model. You know, a lot of times I've got an app installed for a little while and use it a couple times, and then it comes up with a message that says, how'd you like to give us a review? You know, no thanks, not right now, remind me later. Why not do the same?
There's definitely some plugins that have done that and have done it pretty successfully.
Yeah.
I think a really good example to look at would be MelPoet. I guarantee you, if you go look at their page on WordPress.org, they have, I'm going to see if I can pull it up for you real quick because I'm kind of curious. The number of reviews that they have is insane.
I've actually come across a plugin that says, hey, if this is working great for you and you like it, why don't you give us a 5-star review? And there's a link, and it takes you right to the page with I don't think it's pre-filled already, but it takes you to the page where you can actually do your 5-star review, and they had just an enormous amount of 5-star reviews just
because it
asked them to do it or reminded them.
We found that, so like MelPoet, for example, they do it really, really well, and I think they do it actually in their support channels. I don't know if they do it inside the plugin, but they have almost 1,500 5-star reviews because of that. Now, the plugin is good, but if they had just let those reviews come in naturally, they would probably have 100 or maybe 200 as opposed to 1,500. I found something that works really well is inside of the customer support realm. Anytime you have a happy customer, just say, hey, would you be willing to give us a review if you're happy with the plugin? And a lot of times they'll just ignore it and won't do anything. But the number of people that will say, hey, sure, absolutely, you helped me with my problem, I'll be happy to leave you a review. And it dramatically increased the number of reviews that we got.
And probably positive reviews as well.
Yes.
If they're, you know, if they turn out to be happy customers that you just solved a problem for.
Yep.
And so how does the repository score those reviews as far as the number of 5 stars? Is that what deems its popularity, or is it downloads, or is there any kind of algorithm that determines that?
I don't know the exact algorithm off the top of my head, but I believe it is downloads over a certain time period. So, for example, if you go to the plugins page right now and look at the most popular sidebar, I believe that is the number of downloads over the last 30 days or something like that.
Well, before we wrap it up here, I wanted to WordPress 4.0 is right around the corner, and some of the, you know, speaking of plugins, WordPress 4.0 does have some improvements to the plugin discovery process and the modal for viewing detailed description. I just want to get your thoughts on what you've seen so far in terms of the plugin modal and discovery process in WordPress 4.0.
I'm really liking it. I've been playing with it since it was in really rough beta, and I've been kind of watching it progress, and I think it's magnificent.
And I'm right there with you. I think the detailed modal view with the more of a look of what you would see on .org with the actual plugin header, I think that's pretty nice. And the actual using cards to when you're installing or looking for plugins, the whole card concept is just refreshing. It's just a better layout of the information for the plugin.
Yeah, I think it definitely makes it easier to get a quick idea of the plugins that you're looking at. If we look at the current version and the same version that we've had for the last X number of years,
yeah.
I think really ever since the plugins API was first introduced, or shortly after, all you really have is a name. And a name doesn't really mean much. But having a description and having a rating and things like that all displayed right there for you in the search results definitely makes it a lot easier for that plugin discovery process.
Mm-hmm. So with all that said, Marcus, do you have any questions here before we wrap it up with Pippin?
Well, I think we've covered a lot of it, but where do you see kind of the direction of knowing, you know, some of the future and looking already into the crystal ball of 4.0? Where do you see new plugins going as far as, you know, new things being developed, things that it gets hooked to, things that we can uncouple from, you know, where do you see it going?
I think especially with the introduction of the WordPress JSON API coming
in
WordPress 4.1.
I knew he was going to say that.
Yeah, we're going to see a lot more, not just applications, but we're going to see a lot more cross-platform integration with plugins. We're going to see a lot more mobile apps that directly integrate with specific plugins. We're going to see a lot more, perhaps even desktop apps that directly interact with plugins, web apps, browser extensions, etc. And that really has me excited.
That, you know, when you say that and everything I've read so far about the WordPress JSON API, everyone seems to be excited just because it opens up a slew of opportunities, just an enormous amount of opportunities that didn't exist before.
It does.
So where do people go if they want to study up on that stuff to get to, you know, ride that wave?
They go to wp-json.org, I think. Oh, wait, no, sorry. wp-api.org.
Yep.
Nice.
That's the website dedicated to all things JSON REST API, which right now is slated for WordPress 4.1, but we'll have to see when that happens.
I'm pretty confident it's going to happen.
I mean, they've Ryan McHugh and some of the folks behind it have been hammering away at it for a while, and maybe it could have went into 4.0, but they just want to give it one more release cycle want to make sure it's right before it gets added to the core.
If you ask them right now, they consider it safe to use. So right now, you can actually use it as a plugin. And then once it goes from the plugin form into actually WordPress core, they're not changing it at all. So you can use it safely, and you can actually go ahead and start building your plugins off of it.
So there's this thing I've been reading about other content management systems that have gone with the JSON REST API, and some of them, there's this term called headless, or to the point where everything is API-based, and you can actually create an admin area through the API, the JSON REST API, to where you can think of it this way. Like if you took WordPress, for example, instead of the administration interface you would see for publishing posts and managing content, you could create customized administration panel specifically for a certain purpose or behavior, and it'd be a lot easier to do with the JSON REST API versus what it is now. That's one of the possibilities I think I've seen discussed with what the API will allow.
Yep, I've seen a lot of discussion on that one already.
So that is very exciting times in the realm of WordPress in the future. Pippin, I want to thank you very much again for spending so much of your time on this Wednesday evening with us on WordPress Weekly. Anything in the works that maybe you could tell us? Anything that's in the oven for easy digital downloads? I'm going to break some news here on the show.
Let's see. We've got a couple of things going on right now. We just released a new extension that was pretty fun. It's called Discounts Pro for doing some special automated discounts based on the customer's user level, what they're purchasing, different things like that. We have a Zapier integration coming pretty soon here. And on the affiliate WP side, I'm pretty excited because we're getting really close to releasing a Stripe integration that will allow you to pay out your affiliates with a single click directly to Stripe. So directly from your Stripe account to their debit cards,
awesome.
Which will be pretty cool.
And just for those who don't know really quickly here, what is Affiliate WordPress?
So Affiliate WP is an affiliate marketing plugin an affiliate management plugin for managing affiliates for your store, your membership site, or whatever service you have. So you have other people that are known as affiliates that go out and help market your product, and if they drive sales to your site, you reward them with a small commission on that sale. And so Affiliate WP is a system that allows you to manage and track all of that.
So instead of using something like ClickBank or ShareASale, you can have this all housed. You can control everything. It's self-hosted because it's a plugin. You can do it all on your. You can manage your affiliate program all on your own with your own website.
Yep, that's correct.
That is very cool.
And it works for both digital stuff and like services, recurring services, things like that too.
Yeah. Right now, it integrates with almost all of the primary e-commerce plugins and membership plugins. So everything from WooCommerce to EDD to iThemes Exchange to MemberMouse to Paid Memberships Pro, Restricted Content Pro, et cetera. We've got about 10 different platforms that we integrate with, as well as the ability to integrate with just about anything else available.
That is awesome. And if I remember correctly, is Affiliate WordPress free?
No, it is actually a commercial plugin that starts at $49.
I was going to say something like that shouldn't be free, so I'm glad it's not. Awesome. Thank you very much, Pippin. And so where can we keep tabs on you?
The easiest place is pippinsplugins.com. You can find just about everything else from there.
And do you have a handle on Twitter?
I do. It is also pippinsplugins.
Awesome, Pippin's Plugins. Pippin, thank you very thanks again very much for being on the show on this Wednesday evening, this late night edition of WordPress Weekly, and keep on doing what you're doing. I mean, again, thank you for volunteering your time with the WordPress Plugin Directory, and just keep on doing what you're doing. Some people here in the chat room think you're a robot, but I think you're human.
It was my pleasure. Thanks, guys.
Awesome. So that wraps it up with our interview with Pippin Williamson, just an awesome developer, awesome guy with awesome products. Marcus, you want to round out the show with your three plugin picks of the week?
Absolutely. The first one being HTML5 Slideshow Presentations. This is like hosting your own SlideShare within WordPress. It's pretty cool because it's got a pretty familiar tool set that you're used to. And I wish it had more PowerPoint-style integration into it, but it does a really good job for what it is. Next one is called Sidebar Automizer. This is a pretty cool one. Jeff, sometimes there's times where, the content isn't that much, but it seems like the sidebar goes on forever and there's this big, huge blank space in between. Well, this plugin actually snips the sidebar to be as short as whatever your content height is. So it gets rid of a couple widgets over there. So you kind of order which ones you are able to be put on the cutting room floor, so to speak, and it does all the rest.
Interesting.
And the final one is called Update from Bottom. And what this does is it basically shows two extra buttons, a scroll to top and a publish/update, on the bottom of the screen. So if you've got one of those kinds of setups within your WordPress installation where you've got a lot of these meta boxes and custom boxes and things like that, and it just seems like it goes on forever, well, this will have the update right there at the bottom for you. So it's pretty nice that you don't have to go all the way back up to the top to hit update and then go all the way back down to the bottom. It's just a little simple time saver if you're an editor. So that's called Update from Bottom, and those are the three plugins of the week.
And I wonder how many of those Pippin reviewed in the WordPress Plugin Director. I wonder if any of those sound familiar to him.
A couple of them.
There he is. He hasn't left us yet. That's pretty cool. I know at least a few people who have been interested in, WordPress.com. They have this little arrow in the center of your screen at the top where anytime you click on it, it'll take you right up to the top of the screen. So some people have been wondering if there's a plugin or anything that exists where you can integrate that into a WordPress self-hosted install. So plugin sounds like it's halfway there, except that it's on the bottom of the page.
Well, it does have the scroll to top, so it doesn't matter where you are. I mean, if you're scrolling down, it just stays on the bottom.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, I might have to check that out and maybe post a review on the Tavern, which, by the way, is where you can find show notes for this episode and all previous episodes of WordPress Weekly. And you can follow me on Twitter at Jeffro, that's J-E-F-F-R-0. And Marcus Couch at MarcusCouch.com and at Marcus Couch on Twitter, correct?
That's correct. And I guess we should probably announce that I'll be around every week.
Oh, I guess we should announce that. Oh, I guess Marcus Couch is going to be around next week and the week after and the week after. And the week after.
Yeah. So we're going to team up and bring you some nighttime follies and fun on WordPress Weekly every week. And I can't wait to interact with all the rest of the guests. I'm going to try and spring some crazy guests on you myself and see what we can do.
Oh, just fantastic. So it's every Wednesday night, 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. That's our new recording time. If you want to join in on the festivities live and participate in the chat room like we've had so many awesome people do tonight, that's when you'll be able to do that. And that's going to do it for this episode of WordPress Weekly. I'll talk to you again next Wednesday evening. Until then, have a safe weekend, everybody.